Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need to update your window treatments with Window Images blinds and shades. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Plus, get them trimmed to width in-store for free. Also, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am really excited to have back with me today Justin Harvey. Frequent listeners will know Justin's been on the show twice before. He is a fabulous person and the founder of APM Wealth, also the founder and host of the Anesthesia and Pain Medicine Success Podcast, also known as the APM Success Podcast. He's a financial planner, and he has done really fabulous work with specifically anesthesiologists and pain medicine specialists. He's really an expert in this area. He's given us some great advice over the years on the podcast for folks, and I'm really grateful to him for that. And it's been a while, so we thought time to do an update. So I'm excited to have him back. And Justin, welcome back to the show.
Dr. Wolpaw, pleasure to be here. Pleased to be addressing your audience once again after a few years. It's a pleasure.
It's amazing how fast the time flies. And we were offline talking about how, in the meantime, our children have grown, and it's amazing. Things just fly, but definitely fun to see you again. So let's start by talking a little bit about what's going on. It's a crazy time in anesthesia. Compensation, since we last talked, it's reached a whole other level. So tell us a little bit from your perspective, what's happening with compensation and the employment outlook in anesthesia?
Yeah, so at baseline, it's not possible for America to manufacture enough providers of anesthesia of all different types, MD, DO, CRNA, and others. And with the, you know, sort of the demographic bulge of the baby boom that is moving more and more into procedure land, it's just anybody who's listening to this podcast is never going to have to look too hard to find someone who wants to hire them. That continues to be true, and that is continuing to push upward pressure, put upward pressure on wages, as I have observed in the last few years. I have here the MGMA data for anesthesiology for 2024, which is looking at 2023 numbers. And I can tell you that it's moving up every single year. And anecdotally, I'm talking to my clients and I'm seeing their real-time changes in compensation across all different practice models. And typically what I'm seeing is that anesthesiologists' compensation on a sort of apples-to-apples basis is going up, and it's going up more than inflation, reflective of these broader trends.
Yeah, fabulous. So that's a good news for anybody, as you said, probably anybody listening to this podcast, whether they are a practicing anesthesiologist or CRNA right now, or they're in training, or they're a medical student thinking about doing it. And this also we see reflected in the just skyrocketing competitiveness of anesthesia as a field. I know very firsthand how hard it is to get into anesthesia residency. I've heard anecdotally that it's getting harder and harder to get into CRNA school. So, I mean, I think this is just what's happening. The market is making it a much more competitive specialty than it ever has been before. How does subspecialty choice impact this? So, you know, I think this is probably less true, though it's not just not my world. I don't know as much about it for CRNAs, but certainly for anesthesia residents, they are often these days torn. Do they do a fellowship or do they not do a fellowship? I'm sure you have clients asking you these questions. How do you counsel them? What are the things they should take into account?
Yeah. This is a great topic, and I'm very interested in not only the sort of career implications, but the economic implications, which is more my specialty, but they're both really important. And then there's personal and lifestyle considerations as well. I just recently talked to, I don't know if you know Dr. Jimmy Turner, who—
I do. I've had him on the show. Yeah.
Yeah. He has a podcast called Money Meets Medicine, and we just talked about the economic impact of a fellowship. And good reasons to do a fellowship would be, for example, a clinical expertise that is a subspecialization that is so unique that, like, I couldn't do it without the fellowship. That would be a good reason to do that. And you want to focus on that subspecialty going forward. A bad reason would be, I have imposter syndrome. I'm not quite ready for private practice, so I'm going to, like, kill some time and do the take the path of least resistance, which is staying in the comfort zone of academic land while I sort of work some things out. Now, this is easy for me to say. I'm not a doctor, so you have to all take this with a grain of salt. But I would say if that is a – or even like a fear of, oh, my gosh, if I don't have three board certifications, I'm not going to be able to find a job. Like, that is patently false. So these would be not good motivations. And the economic impact of being on that PGY scale – for one extra year, or God forbid, two or three extra unnecessary years, it's very large. And if you save a meaningful amount of the delta, meaning like if I take that first year of attending hood and I, you know, take Dr. Dolly's advice and I live like a resident for one more year and I bank the entire difference, not for forever, but for 1 year, the effect at age 65 is a seven-figure number. Somewhere between 1 and 2 million, depending on your assumptions, per year of fellowship. That's assuming that the fellowship does not increase your earning potential. So if I do an additional board certification that doesn't make me make more money, then it's going to cost me $1 to $2 million at retirement. Now, if you're going to retire with like $9 or $10 or $11 million anyway, does that really matter? Perhaps it does not. And if that puts you on a clinical path that you really like and are going to be happy with, then that's all we need to know, and then fellowship is a good fit. But there is a real economic trade-off that needs to be acknowledged. And, you know, in the specialty of anesthesiology, pain medicine is a good example. Like, if you're doing pain, especially if you're going to do exclusively pain, that's its own thing. So you can't just start doing pain without the fellowship. But there are other parts of anesthesia that you can continue to do. You know, my wife did not do a fellowship, and she is very busy at the trauma center here locally doing all kinds of things. High acuity. She's very happy. And I think we would both look back now and say, there was a time when we were talking about, should we do it? Should we not? I didn't know then what I know now about the trade-offs, but it has worked out for us, I will say.
Yeah. And that's an important point. I'm glad you brought up your wife because, you know, for folks who maybe didn't listen to the last couple episodes you've been on, the fact that you're married to an anesthesiologist, I think is really significant, right? I mean, you have a real insider's look at this, not just from your clients, but from your wife as well. And I think that gives you a huge benefit in terms of how you can look at this. I agree with you. And the advice, you know, take it or leave it, that I give our residents is that, like you said, I don't think doing a fellowship just to do a fellowship is a good move ever, and certainly not in the era where it can be a, you know, seven-figure change in your eventual, you know, financial situation. But I also don't think money should be everything. Now, I do think that there are some people for whom actually there really isn't a choice, right? Like, they may have a sick family member who they're supporting that they need to make the money now. But for most people, I think they can do it. And the question is it worth it? And so the question I tell residents to ask themselves is, if you look at the next 30, 40 years ahead of you of practicing anesthesiology, do you think you would be equally happy whether you did a fellowship and whatever that career path was, or versus if you didn't? And if the answer is yes, then it's not worth doing the fellowship. But if getting to, like the example you gave, if getting to practice pain medicine, or like me, I could not practice critical care in an academic setting like I do without having done an ICU fellowship. If getting to do that, which for me, it absolutely does make my career richer and make my job satisfaction higher. If that's the case, then 40 years of increased job satisfaction in my mind is absolutely worth the financial sacrifice, especially when you're still going to be doing quite well financially, right? Right. So that's the question to ask yourself. And that doesn't make it easy because it's hard to look forward in time and figure that out. But that, I think, is the way to try to think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
So, Justin, you work with a lot of docs. What are some of the common financial mistakes that you see them making in, let's say, the first 5 years out of training? Maybe this can be a good way for people to try to avoid those mistakes if they're just getting started.
Yeah. So transitioning from training into attending hood, it's just a totally crazy and tumultuous time, typically, because you're usually thinking about getting married, or maybe you've been married recently. You're usually thinking about starting a family if you want to have kids. You're maybe relocating. You're probably getting a 5 to 10x raise. And there's just a lot of noise personally, financially, and it can be hard to even get oriented in terms of what's most important. It's always a good idea, you know, if we think about a couple big decisions you're going to be making when you finish training. You might be buying a house. You're probably going to accept a job. You're probably going to have different needs in terms of insurance. You're probably going to be making more money and you need to do something with it. A lot of the mistakes are often associated with these decisions. So if somebody was to take a job and not hire a lawyer to look at the contract, I think that's a terrible, stupid thing to do. Like if there's $500,000 on the line, pay someone $500 to look at it and make sure that you're not going to have this thing blow up in a way that is going to be critical to your ongoing success and happiness. As your income increases, your needs for insurance increase. Like you should probably look at all of your home, auto, umbrella insurance and what you've been sort of skating by with whenever you're on the PGY pay scale. It's just not a good idea to maintain those low policy limits anymore. So like on auto, you should probably have like the highest possible limits on your auto coverage, and you should probably throw an umbrella on top of that. Homeowners, robust insurance is really important. One of the benefits of being a high income professional is there's a lot of things in life we can't control. But if there's a portion of the risk that we have to like interact with in the world and of unpredictability, if we can export that risk in exchange for a fixed cost of an insurance premium, like, and you can do that without meaningful problem threat to your lifestyle because you make a lot of money, like you should do that every time. So I encourage my clients or anybody who will listen, rethink your insurance for all these, you know, raise your limits. Obviously life insurance is a big one. Disability insurance is a huge one. You know, when you're finishing training, if you're 31 years old and you're getting ready to make the, you know, and the MGMA median number is in excess of $500,000 for anesthesiologists most recently, the number I have here in front of me. If that's the number and you do that for 20 years, that's $10 million. If you do it for 30 years, that's $15 million of income. The biggest asset you probably have as a 31-year-old is that $15 million that you're going to earn over the next handful of decades. And so protecting that robustly with a good disability policy, you know, if you have loved ones, you should have life insurance. You should have $3, $4, $5, $6 million of term coverage that is transparently priced, generally affordable, going to provide a good layer of protection for your family while you need it. And then it will roll off and expire worthless at the conclusion of that policy, which is great. That's what you hope for. I have some clients who are like, Justin, you know, insurance companies are making a lot of money off of me. I'm like, that's exactly what you want. You want this policy to expire worthless because that means you lived long enough for that to happen. And then if the inverse is true, like if you, and your family receives a death benefit, then you're really glad you had that coverage so that your you know, spouse isn't trying to figure out how to pay the mortgage with a, perhaps not an anesthesia skill set.
Totally.
So all those things are, you know, revisiting and recalibrating, just understanding that it's a different ballgame now. And so as you make the transition and for those first few years, the last thing I would say is there's going to be a lot more dollars flying around. You're going to get that first direct deposit into your checking account. And first of all, celebrate it in a memorable fashion, but in a way that my personal recommendation is in a way that doesn't result in monthly payments. So go to the nicest dinner you've ever eaten, buy the most awesome bottle of bourbon you've ever consumed, but don't do something that you're going to pay for the next 7 years at hundreds or thousands per month. But then take the other free dollars before this time when your lifestyle has expanded and automate some wealth building. So whether it's in an investment account, whether you're paying off debt, do it so that it's automatic. It's happening from your checking account every month, like clockwork, requires no emotional energy, is moving your net worth in the right direction. It's going to meaningfully accelerate your journey towards financial independence.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. I have some questions that came from all that. So
great.
You mentioned having a lawyer look over the contract. What we often hear, and tell me if you disagree, but is that that's super important in private practice, probably less important in academics, since most academic centers, there's really no negotiation. It's a set contract that every attending gets. But tell me, you're more of an expert on this. What do you think?
What I have observed, I've looked at a lot of contracts, and I'm not a lawyer, so I have a different sort of perspective on this. I have helped clients of mine negotiate 5-figure signing bonuses with Ivy League institution anesthesia departments that wasn't in the original draft. So I have seen that, like, this can happen with anybody. You can get a better deal. You don't, we actually didn't, for that one, we didn't have a lawyer involved. I think the primary benefit of an attorney is not as much like redlining and like restructuring an agreement, although sometimes that happens. It's educating the consumer, which is you, the physician who's taking the job, about the expectations of the what is contractually obligated, and specifically, like, if and when you quit or leave or retire or are fired or whatever happens, like, what are the implications in the months that follow? Do you have to pay back some kind of bonus? Are you, is there like collection production pay that like you were expecting that you're not going to get? Is there a non-compete that applies in some circumstances but not others? It's not even as much like changing the contract as it is just knowing, so that you can, you know, if you decide I want to quit this job a year from now and maybe I'll give notice in 6 months, you can plan your life, plan your spending, plan your cash emergency fund in a way that is going to make that minimally stressful, rather than finding out whenever you get a nasty gram from the employer's legal department about how you're running afoul of some of your the things to which you have agreed contractually.
And what have you found? Let's say that someone did. They get a lawyer. The lawyer says, okay, here's the deal. Yeah, this, by the way, so you know, has this non-compete. You know, can people say, have you had people successfully negotiate, either negotiate away the non-compete or limit it?
Yes, and non-compete is it's political. It's been a topic of interest in the White House in the last few years. Anything is up for negotiation. So I've seen basically any term in a contract I've seen change at some point. Now, whether or not a certain counterpart, like a big academic institution, whether or not they're going to budge on a non-compete, depends on how valuable you are to them. If you have some like compelling research and they really like the idea of adding you to their department and you have friends in high places, anything is possible. I will say that's a case in which it's going to be more difficult than a, you know, a smaller, and this is the other thing too, Dr. Wolpaw, it's totally geographically dependent. Every region, every city, they have their own sort of flavor of the anesthesia landscape and medicine in general, but anesthesia in particular. Some states are like a lot of private practice. Some states are dominated by a big private equity backed group. Others are a lot of hospital employed. Others where it's like rural, you know, it's like a combination of hospital employed and locums just because it's hard to recruit. So those variables are also going to be meaningful determinants of the nature of the negotiation and the flexibility you're going to experience as part of the dialogue around that.
Yeah, great. How about term versus whole life? You laid out kind of you should have all this term insurance. I have found that insurance brokers love to try to sell you whole life insurance. You know, what do you recommend to your clients?
Yeah, well, this is a tool. Insurance is a tool. So there's a job that is suitable for every tool. I will say that whole life insurance, I see it a lot more than I wish that I did. Meaning it's sold to a lot of people who don't need it. And typically it's more costly. It does, I will say economically, this is one thing to be aware of. Whenever you buy an insurance product, there's always a commission associated. Whole life insurance has beefy commissions. And so I think part of the reason we see a lot of them is because advisors, and I'll put advisors in air quotes this time, insurance salespeople get paid to find reasons to sell whole life. There's a lot of good people, good financial advisors out there stuck in bad business models that incentivize things that aren't necessarily aligned with physician financial success. I think if you're like under the age of 40, you basically should never have a whole life policy. I don't like carte blanche rules like that, but if you're getting sold or pushed something like that, it's probable that it doesn't make sense for you. Now, if you're financially independent, if you're looking for advanced estate or business planning strategies, there can be exceptions. You know, I've even seen some cases where you would get a whole life policy for your kid in a certain sort of scenario where you're preserving their insurability for expansion later on. And if you have some like specific fears or genetic predisposition to something, or, you know, there can be reasons. They could be good reasons. So I don't want to like totally write off the tool, but I will say most of the time, just get term and call it good and you'll probably be fine.
Right. Now, you mentioned it's a good idea to automate wealth building. You said, you know, have automatic transfer from your bank account into something. What about, does that include 529s? Do you recommend people, I mean, assuming you're, you know, if you know you're not going to have kids, doesn't make sense. But if you're going to have kids or you already have kids, like, should they be automatically putting money into a 529?
I do have some clients that don't have kids that do have 529s. for different reasons. You can. The nice thing about 529s is they're portable between relatives. So you could open one for yourself, and maybe you can do some sort of educational program, or you can use that to pay for your nieces and nephews or any things like that. I will say 529 benefit is attached to the jurisdiction in which you live. So one of the benefits is you get a state income tax deduction, meaning if you put $10,000 into a 529 and your state permits it, your state taxable income will be reduced by $10,000 and your state income tax will be reduced by your state income tax rate times $10,000. So to use an example, if it's a 6% state income tax rate, you put 10 grand into 529, $10,000, 6%, $600 reduction in your state taxes. So that's one of the benefits. The other benefit is the tax-free growth that you enjoy of the 529 until whenever you take it out for a qualifying education expense sometime in the future, there's no taxes on the growth there. Some people only enjoy one of these benefits, meaning if you live in Florida, Texas, Nevada, another Washington, another state that doesn't have state income tax, you don't get a deduction. So that's one sort of drawback, but you do get the tax-free growth. You also want to consider a 529 is a restricted asset. It can only be used for certain purposes, meaning qualifying educational expenses. So it doesn't always make sense to have $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 in a 529 because if your kid wants to become a welder or gets a big scholarship or doesn't want to go to grad school and ends up doing an in-state tuition program that's more affordable, you can end up with a bunch of extra money that you're like, well, we either got to give this to a sibling of my child or some other family member, or we have to take it out and deal with the penalties associated with not using it for a qualifying expense. So often what I will do is, if we're talking about college funding, I'll say, let's think about the presumed total cost of attendance based on your child's likely trajectory, based on your state of residence and all that. And then let's fund somewhere between 40 and 70% of the presumed total cost with a 529. That gives you some buffer to say, we'll just pay for some from cash flow. We'll maybe allow our kid to, you know, chip in for some. We're going to apply for scholarships, and we're going to actually, this is a good, sort of as an aside, one thing, Dr. Wolpaw, that I'm particularly interested in, and I'll bet you would be too, but you've thought about this, is like, how do I create a child who understands the value of a dollar, who isn't going to be a spoiled brat, who, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you may be in a top 1%, top 5% income household, if not today, then someday, and you're going to have headwinds for having normal, respectful, hardworking children who understand the value of a dollar. One way to help them to learn this is to invite them as a stakeholder in their own education to say, listen, mom and dad worked really hard. We saved a bunch of money. We're going to pay for half. We've got it in a 529. The other half is on you, or, you know, whatever the arrangement is. And you give them notice so that through a combination of them working and maybe even you, like if you, for the other half, like you'll give them a match. There's ways to create incentive, but the point is give them some skin in the game and use it to as a motivator rather than a, you've got a blank check, kid, do whatever you want. And if it takes you 4.5 or 5 or 6 years to, you know, find yourself, then it's no big deal. That's not the right message, as I'm sure you can agree.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, I actually heard Gordon Ramsay interviewed on a podcast the other day, and he was saying that as his kids were growing up, he and his wife never let the kids fly first class. So they would fly, he and his wife would be in first class, the kids would be sitting back in coach, and that was always the case. And they were told their kids, like, you got to know what it's like. You know, you need to earn, this is the incentive. You want to be able to fly up here one day, you got to work hard. And I love
that. Yeah, I like that.
So let's talk about the different practice settings. You know, it used to be that we would have most of our residents do fellowship. Some go into private practice, and the ones who went to fellowship, you know, would either just join a private practice or stay academic. It was really just those two options, right? After training, whether that was fellowship or not, it was either a private practice group or it was academic medical center. And now, though those are absolutely still possibilities, we also have different, we have physician-owned groups. We have private equity-owned groups. Locums has become a huge thing. What I think of as 1099 employees, so folks who maybe are their own kind of independent contractor, not working for a locums agency. So there's lots of things out there. I'm sure you have clients in all these different things. What are kind of some of the pros and cons and things to think about if a person is trying to decide which of these to do?
Great question. Similar to the fellowship question, taking a full orbed view of what you want your life to look like is a necessary first step. So, you know, in academic medicine, there is a lot of intangible, I mean, both, frankly, there's like the infrastructure, the full cadre of benefits, both in terms of like compensation, but also retirement plans. Maybe there's like a tuition reimbursement thing, and maybe there's, you know, access to resources and other, it's a very different experience than, okay, I'm 1099 and I'm like trying to direct contract with a surgery center down the street. So if you like being the hired gun type, then you don't want to be, you know, in the ivory tower. But if you like the collegiality of, you know, advancing the specialty and the research that comes with that, and the, you know, the benefits of like, I want to send my kid to this institution and I get it free tuition, you know, like that's huge. We just talked about 529s, and it's nice to not need them if you can send your kid for free. So all of that has to be considered. I will say that the wealth building journey in terms of the economics of these different settings, it's helpful to think about the differences and understand that to optimize the wealth building journey in the different settings, it's helpful to understand the characteristics of each. So if you're in the academic world and you have a 403B, maybe you have a 457, maybe you've got some other, I mean, like a 401A, or there's other tax deferred opportunities depending on the institution. You just want to understand what are all of these and how do they all work. A 403B is almost always worth using, maxing out, investing aggressively as a young doctor and letting it ride, letting it grow for the future. 457s, which is it's a different type of retirement plan. It functions like a 403B in that it's a pre-tax paycheck deferral into an account, the same limit, $23,500, but it's an unsecured asset of your employer, which basically means there's a lot of limitations that you experience in a 457 that you don't in a 403B. I will say there's two types of 457s, and without going all the way down the rabbit hole, you've got to know if it's a tax exempt or non or a governmental plan. Those are two different types of 457s. The governmental is more friendly with more options for, can I roll this into an IRA? Can I roll it into my new 401k? Can I take it with me when I go? Versus a tax exempt, which is like, you have to distribute it when you leave, or you have to distribute it in installments over 5 years when you leave, or you have to just let it sit until age 65. The options are much more limited. They're so limited, in fact, that if you have a tax-exempt 457, I will often encourage clients to actually not use them, even though it is pre-tax. Like I could, I'm not maximizing my pre-tax savings if I'm not using this 457, but because the options are so limited, doesn't always make sense. Because imagine you save $23,000 in a year for 4 years into this account. It grows to $120,000, and then you want to leave. And now you're like, all right, well, I guess I got to distribute this 457. It's $120,000 of income taxed at ordinary income rates. And so all you did was like create a big tax problem for yourself. And you sort of accumulated that tax problem and then dropped it on your head all at once. The governmental 457 is not like that. It would roll into a new employer plan. So in the academic setting, understanding the flavors of the different plans is helpful. Conversely, if you're in, I'll take the other sort of extreme end, like locums or 1099. So 1099 is the tax form that indicates self-employment income. So you could be working through a locums agency, or you could be direct contracting with a site of service, and you're, you know, maybe you're making your own schedule. Maybe you're like, I've got income goals. I want to make $1.2 million a year by just doing back-to-back call shifts for... till I can't see straight. I know some people that do that. And if you're like motivated to pay off debt, or you want to pay for that, you know, whatever the motivation is, that's cool. When you're self-employed, which is what that is, it's self-employment, your income creates a responsibility for you. With responsibility, there's a lot of flexibility and opportunity. You can do a solo 401k, meaning a one-person 401k plan, where you're saving for yourself, you can do a match for yourself, you can generally save all the way up to what's called the Section 415 limit, which is $70,000, 70,000 for 2025, in a 401k as the one-man show. So if you're working locums and you're making $500,000 or $600,000 or $700,000, you can shield a meaningful amount of that from taxes by using a solo 401k. that solo 401k is not available to you if you are working in a private equity group or an academic institution, only if you're self-employed. In addition, when you're self-employed, you can take deductions. You're running a business. You're expensing miles. You're expensing meals. You're expensing the new laptop that you needed to buy in order to do the job that you do. And so there's some privileges that come with business ownership. And there's also, I need a CPA who's going to be engaged because the tax complexity is a little bit greater and all of that. I think there's a happy medium in terms of, I see people who have like a main gig, we'll call it, where they're getting either in an academic setting. I have some clients who are doing this, or in just a bigger private group or even a smaller private group. Plus, they have enough vacation that they dedicate some of their vacation to doing that 1099 or locums work, where you've got your W-2 wages and you've got the benefits of the employment infrastructure. You've got your company 401k from your employer. You've got the HSA and the healthcare. Plus, maybe you've got another 100 grand of self-employment income from the locums work. And you're doing the solo 401k on the basis of that locums work. And you're taking some expenses. And you're sort of enjoying the benefit of both sides. That's a really interesting place to be. And when we talk about automating savings and making, like, accelerating the financial progress through the different parts of the healthcare ecosystem, that can be an interesting opportunity.
Yeah. Go ahead.
One last one that I'll mention. So in terms of like the private groups, so the private practice means a lot of different things, as you pointed out. Sometimes it's like a physician owned, sometimes it's private equity owned and still technically private because it's not a nonprofit, it's not a hospital, it's a group that is not publicly held. In the private equity backed groups, which is a meaningful percentage of anesthesiologists in America, these tend to be a little bit skinnier in terms of benefits. In some cases, depending on the market, we see compensation be higher to attract physicians. But in this setting in particular, it's very important to lean into the automation, lean into the contributions from your checking account into other investment accounts. And usually it means not just your 401k, because you're going to max out your 401k. And then you've got to be saving probably, approaching six figures or into six figures. You know, we use round numbers, $500,000 of income, $100,000 of savings, that's a 20% savings rate. I typically encourage my clients to at least start at 20% and see if that can be reasonably accommodated.
Now, Justin, let me just ask you about that. Yeah. So someone who's making whose salary is $500,000 a year is taking home after taxes what, $300,000 maybe,
depending on the state. Yeah.
So let's just to make the numbers easy. Yeah. Let's just say $300,000. So, but you still would say that they should actually. So then, what if they're saving $100,000? That's actually 33% of their take home income, and that's what you would recommend.
That's another way to express it. Now, if they're maxing out their 401k, they are reducing their taxable income, and that $300 is going to creep up a little bit. But you point out, taxes are expensive. Frankly, when you're an attending, they're probably going to be the biggest expense every year for the rest of your life. And that's why tax-sensitive saving strategies are really important.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, if you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through the echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. The other day, I heard a murmur that my colleague with a regular stethoscope just couldn't hear. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis. Echo is backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in every area with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart sounds and lung conditions more confidently. If you don't, return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACCRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/ACCRAC.
Hey, ACRACers, we are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks.
I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME Smart Bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology Smart Bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex Smart Bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC. Hey, folks, I want to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs, made for awesome humans. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves her so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a med student starting out. Investing in a couple pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need to update your window treatments with Window Images blinds and shades. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Plus, get them trimmed to width in-store for free. Also, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. All right, and we're back.
Yeah. Okay, great. Just so everyone understands the numbers, basically the more you can save, the better.
Yeah. And it depends on your goals. So I'm laying out an aggressive – usually when I'm working with clients, they want to be to the place where they – do medicine for the love of the game and not because they need the paycheck anymore. And so they are motivated. They're like, Justin, if you tell me 22% is my number so I can be done by age 51, then we're going to find a way to make it happen. That's not inherently, you know, that's not inherently everyone's goal, and that's fine. Like, you should do what you want to do. But when it is attached to a goal, it's easier to do it because you know what you're moving toward. And so if I told someone, you know, save 100 grand and like, oh my gosh, I can't. It wouldn't surprise me that they can't find the motivation if they're not wanting to be economically free sooner than their peers. But for those folks that are like on the warpath to get there quickly, they can summon the resources typically.
Yeah. Okay. So sorry, I interrupted you to ask about the taxes thing and you were going to say something else.
Yeah. So if you're in an institution where I'll say it's a little less benefits rich, and I have observed that this is true in some of the private equity backed groups, you've got to make it happen elsewhere. You can't you don't have the 403B and the 457 and the 401A and maybe like a pension plan if you're also related to the municipality. You've got to do the 401K, which is 23.5. And then you're probably looking at we got a backdoor Roth IRA we can do, maybe one for your spouse if you're married. And then we've got taxable investments, which is this other bucket that I haven't really talked about yet, but it's just a regular brokerage account that you can put money into, invest in mutual funds, ETFs, individual stocks, whatever, index fund. If you're going to do it yourself, I'd say let's keep it, do index funds, keep it kind of broadly diversified. And that taxable investment account for you in particular, if you're in a benefits scarce setting, it's got to be an important part of your solution because you just don't have a lot of other places to be building wealth. So plan to rely on that. Plan to set multiple thousands per month, you know, maybe $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 a month automatic deposit into that taxable account and get that automatically invested and get that rolling for you, because just maxing out your 401k every year is not going to be enough to get you where you want to go.
Yeah. All right. Fabulous. Let's talk about student loans. We've talked about this every time you've had you on. It's important. Yeah. So many people have them. And public service loan forgiveness, it's changed a lot. There was a time when it was, the idea was just pay, get to the 10 years. Then people weren't having to pay at all. And a lot of people got forgiven. And now I think last I heard, there's some talk about getting rid of it for doctors. So give us the update.
Yeah. It's evolving by the minute. So today is June 11th. there's a bill before the Senate, a big, beautiful bill, I'm told, that is in part holding the fate of student loan repayment plans. And frankly, there's so much in flux. I'm going to give you some things that are known right now and that borrowers can do. There's a lot that's outside your control. The first thing you want to acknowledge is like, because there's so much outside of our control, we should focus on the things we can control. So the most basic thing every student loan borrower should consider is, what is my baseline trajectory for these loans? Am I going for full repayment or am I going for a forgiveness strategy? Now, if you're a physician, typically there's not a forgiveness strategy that makes sense that isn't PSLF, with the exception of, well, there are some exceptions, but I'm going to talk to PSLF for a minute because that's the big one. And so if you're going for PSLF, what that means is you want to pay the least you can every month for as many months as is required until you achieve forgiveness. That's 120 months, 10 years worth of payments. You've got to be on an income-driven plan. Revised pay-as-you-earn existed a few years ago. That was replaced by the SAVE plan. A lot of people were forced onto the SAVE plan. The SAVE plan was then deemed by court injunction to be not a legal repayment plan. So now there's a lot of people in limbo. You can't necessarily control the limbo. But what you can control is how many qualifying payments do I have right now? And what I would say is go to studentaid.gov, look at your qualifying payments, say how many have I made, how much of my employment qualifies, and do I have payments counting for each potential payment that I've made that should count? If not, what you need to do is do your employer certification form where you'll fill out the ECF and the portal now has a pretty intuitive tool, the PSLF help tool, where you're going to enter in the information of any qualifying employer. You're going to put in the dates and the HR contact, and they'll send that away for countersignature, and then you will get the credit. And as far as I can tell, this mechanism of the infrastructure is still functioning properly. So if all your months haven't counted yet, get up to date on that. If you find yourself in save forbearance and don't want to be, or you're wondering about buyback. So there's this other thing called buyback, where if you have been in periods of involuntary forbearance, you'll be able to pay retroactively the amount that should have been associated with those months of forbearance in order to get the PSLF credit that would be due to you. Buyback is, I just saw an email the other day. There's a long, long, long queue of buyback requests. Something like 2 or 4% of them have been processed. It's very slow going. It's hard to say what the destination is of the buyback train. If we get back to the 35,000-foot view for a minute, I haven't seen anything that makes me think that PSLF is going away for people who are current participants who have been in good faith completing this process. If you're one of those people who's like 6, 7, 8, 8.5 years in, if I was a betting man, and I've got a lot of clients in this position that I've been helping along, if I was a betting man, I'd say, we're going to get there. There's a lot of variables that still need to be codified, clarified. There's a new payment plan that probably needs to be created. But my intuition is that Congress, for all of these borrowers who are already doing, who have been on the path, they're not going to change the rules of the game for these people. There's a lot of talk about changes on a go-forward basis for new borrowers starting in 2026 and following, and this is a whole separate conversation, but I think that probably should happen. I think having uncapped borrowing with no credit underwriting for higher education where you don't have to prove that the degree is going to make you enough money to pay those loans back, like there's a reason that banks don't do that because you would go bankrupt. So does it make sense for the government to do that? I'm not sure. Does that contribute to the inflation that we've seen in cost of attendance? Almost certainly. But that's a whole separate group of borrowers. So for today's borrowers, one additional thing I would say is there are people, I'm thinking about student loan planner, which is a company, studentloanplanner.com. My friend Travis Hornsby started that company and does student loan analysis. It's their primary business is they will help you with a specific student loan plan. Whether it's them, there's a number of other experts out there. CSLP is a designation, Certified Student Loan Planner. That is it's kind of like the CFP. So I'm a CFP, Certified Financial Planner. The CSLP is a student loan equivalent designation for a financial person to be an expert in student loans. So consulting with someone like that, with Travis's team or with another CSLP professional, could be worth doing to get a detailed plan so that you know what lies ahead. Now, I will say this. Even the experts are as limited as the rest of us, just waiting to hear from Capitol Hill. Like, is this payment plan going to be here tomorrow or not? It's hard to plan in detail with a lot of those like payment plan specific questions. Should I do buyback today versus, should I get on this plan versus that plan? Those specifics, unfortunately, right now in the environment that we're in, it's just very, very, very difficult to give good advice because we're just working with partial information. If you've never had a consult with a group like that, I would say getting one is a good idea. If it was me, I'd probably wait like 3 months just to let some dust settle. Maybe there will be a new payment plan that gets rolled out. We'll understand a little bit more about what that is, and then we can commit to something that actually is going to exist. But all of those things I think are worth considering. The other thing I would say is if you're on the other track, so I talked about PSLF for a bit. If you're on the other track, the full repayment track, then all this noise is just that. It's noise. You should probably be, you want to pay off your loans aggressively, as aggressively as possible is what I would say. And so getting a good interest rate, you know, if you're on the save forbearance and you have 0% still, meaning you're not accruing interest currently for the rest of 2025, perhaps, if that's you, great, leave it alone. If the interest rate kicks back up and you're seeing that you're at the 6, 7, 8% interest, that's a good time to consider refinancing. So you're going to want to go to a private bank, SoFi, Earnest, LendKey, one of those guys, and taking your, 7% and refinancing it at 5% or something like that. And then you can get on a fixed payment plan and knock it out. It's important to note that when you do this, you're permanently saying no to PSLF. You can't undo this. This is an irrevocable action. So that if you change your mind, if you like find a great private practice job and you're like, all right, I finished training and I'm in private practice. PSLF is not open to me. So I'm going to go ahead and refi. And then that private practice group gets absorbed by the hospital. And then all of a sudden your job does qualify because you're actually technically paid by a 501c3 and you refinanced. Too bad, so sad. There's no going back. So you got to be really, 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 really 110% sure that when you refi, that is the path that you want. It's an easier decision if you've only got $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 outstanding. If you've got like $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 of student loans, the stakes are higher. So just be really sure. Actually, I had one client in particular coming to mind who it was this exact situation. They got the job at the private practice. She said, all right, Justin, I'm ready to refi. And I was like, you just took this job. Let's just let it simmer. Let's make sure the job is what we think it is. And turns out it was a very pernicious work environment. All the call was stacked onto the associate doctors and all the partners were a little less participatory in the call pool, shall we say, such that it was untenable for her to continue to work there. And she ended up quitting and working at the local academic center in a matter of 9 months or so. And all of a sudden she's back on the PSLF train and now she's moving expeditiously towards forgiveness, which I've got my fingers crossed that we're going to get there. And I think we will. But the point is, had she done that refi whenever she took the private practice job, she would have been out of luck and had to, on the academic salary, repaying the entirety of her loans. So it's not easy. The path forward is not always clear, but in particular with that refi decision, always just double and triple check that your trajectory is what you think it is before committing to that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Justin, when you look across your clients, are there things that when you think about the ones that are having the most success, are there things that are kind of in common that you can say, here are some things that the people who are doing this right, who are feeling good about it, and from your perspective as their financial advisor are having success that they have in common that you'd kind of point out to people?
Yes. The first thing I would say is getting clear on your values and the goals associated with those values. And if you're married, this means like collective values and joint goals. And the reason that's important is twofold. One is there's going to be trade-offs where we're going to spend a little more or we're going to sacrifice in a certain area to move towards a value or a goal. And so it gives you that sort of paradigm for decision-making. The second is it will allow you to splurge, to spend lavishly in certain areas that are in accordance with your goals, that are in alignment with your values. I wouldn't say that like my most successful clients who are moving towards financial independence, they're not all super miserly. They're not all super frugal. I have a couple that are very frugal, but it's that they know who they are. They know what's important. They identify their goals and they have a couple areas where they're willing to splurge and they have things that really make them happy. And in terms of investing in their family culture and their relationships, maybe it's generosity or charitable pursuits, they do those things with meaningful amounts of their resources. But then there's also things that they're saying no to because they're like, we don't value those things because of the values that we do have. We're not going to waste money on other things that are less important to us. And therefore, we do also have the resources, in addition to the splurging, to invest and build our net worth. And I'd say that's the second thing is the automation. I mentioned this earlier, the automation of the net worth building process is really important. It's much more difficult to make progress in anything if it requires you to emotionally engage and say, okay, like I got to remember to do this. And then I got to take action to get in and transfer money into the investment account. And then I got to invest it. Like let the robots do that for you. It's 2025, people. Set up automatic everything. Even on just the retail platforms, it's possible to do this. If you just open a Vanguard or a Charles Schwab account, you can typically set up for a certain day of the month, automatic investment. And that will be that's a huge just bit of jet fuel to help people along on their journey. I think other characteristics of people who are successful in pursuing building wealth is that they're less prone to comparison. Either they're wired to be less comparative in terms of lifestyle and keeping up with the Joneses. They're either wired that way or they build the muscles and they create the discipline around. And you know what really helps with that is the conversation around values. If you're tempted to buy the fancy, shiny, new whatever, and you have a conversation with your spouse and you're reminded that, you know what, we do 2 weeks in Europe with the kids every year because we want them to be cultured global cosmopolites. And that's our area of splurging. And so I might not need the new 7 Series Beamer. It's a good refreshing in the values so that you know why you're doing what you're doing. And then you can have the resources to deploy in the ways that are going to make you happy. And then I think the last thing I'll mention is employer plans, while a great start, are not enough. So if you take advantage of all the tax-advantaged accounts available to you, and this is particularly true if you're not married or if your spouse doesn't work outside the home. If it's just you, you've got your 401k or 403b, that's $23,500. You've got your backdoor Roth, that's $7,000. Now we're at $30,500. Maybe your spouse has one, so now we're at $37,000. If you make $500,000, you're saving $37,000. That savings rate is 7-8%. I'm not here to say that that is insufficient, but I will observe that that is going to put you on a sort of a slow track of progress. If that's what you want, that's fine. If it's an intentionally chosen number, but typically people don't want to have to work until they're 65 or 70. They want to be financially free far before then. So that requires that you get into this next tier of savings in taxable investments. So you're opening that taxable account and you're funding that with that $3,000, $5,000, $7,000 a month as a way to augment the retirement plans provided by your employer. The clients of mine that are making the most meaningful progress, they're doing, yes, the employer stuff, but also they're sort of taking matters into their own hands and saying, we know this is not enough. We want our savings rate to be higher, and therefore the taxable account opportunity is something we're going to take advantage of too.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds super, super important. And I think it strikes me as one of those things that you have to put the effort in up front to like commit to it, set up the automatic stuff, but then you just adjust. I mean, it's like how we all adjust, you know, I don't know anybody who, you know, when they become an attending and they're making more money, all of a sudden they're just like, I've got all this money. I don't know what to do with, right? We adjust to the money that we have for better or for worse. So I think if you get rid of that money, you know, automatically, then you're going to see your the money you're left with is what you're going to adjust to. But if you don't do that, you're going to end up adjusting to this higher amount, and it's much harder than to say, actually, now I'm going to give up a few thousand a month.
Absolutely. I don't buy ice cream for a reason, because it evaporates immediately when it hits my freezer. It's gone in like 2 days. I love ice cream, but I don't miss it. I don't actively sit around and think, man, I wish I had some ice cream right now. I put myself in a situation where the baseline decision is the right decision, and then I don't have the emotional angst that comes with trying to do the right thing after that.
Absolutely. Love that analogy. All right, one more question for you. We've heard a lot about, and you know, who knows? This could change any moment, but you know, there may be cuts to Medicaid. There may be there certainly seem to be cuts to NIH funding. How should people be thinking about them? There's a lot of stress out there. People in academics are very stressed about the NIH cuts, even if they're not researchers. You know, their department is looking at cuts. And then, you know, Medicaid cuts, depending on obviously payer mix and stuff, could really affect people in private practice. You know, do people need to worry about that? Any thoughts?
Yeah. So this is going to have asymmetrical impact across different practice settings and specialties. For the purposes of your audience who are in the OR doing anesthesia primarily, or, you know, perhaps regional stuff. Whenever you're in the OR, the good news is you're in the part of the hospital that's making a lot of money. And so you don't need to be a surgeon. You could be an anesthesiologist, and the hospital is strong. And that's why anesthesia pay has continued to go up and not only remain stable, but outpace inflation in recent years. It's because hospitals need to keep making money and they need to keep their ORs cranking. So it's true that they've talked about Medicaid cuts. I mean, frankly, Medicare right now is paying $32 per ASA unit / RVU. I don't know about you, but if you take 32 for, if it's a 15 minute, you know, multiply by an hour, 32 times four is what, $128. I don't know any anesthesiologists who are working for $128 an hour. You couldn't hire someone to do that. So there's already a massive subsidy happening for the specialty, because it's true that there have been cuts and cuts and cuts and cuts and cuts to the physician sort of work reimbursement. But what we're finding is that as those cuts have largely been pushed to the facility, to the hospitals and surgery centers, the hospitals are having to pony up to say, well, we still need anesthesiologists, and they're not willing to work for $120 an hour. And by the way, that $120 is like the pre-tax money that would go to the private practice before they pay for overhead and then they pay for the staff. So it's like an embarrassingly small number. So because there's already such fundamental dislocation in this system, I think a further incremental move, you know, like, are the hospitals going to stop doing surgery? Probably not, because they need them to make money. So I think in the short term, they're just going to find ways to band-aid it together. I do think, you know, in the long term, there's a lot of big economic trends in this country, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare funding or Social Security or defense. Like, there's a lot of big questions that are going to need to be worked out. But I would say, in terms of the acute question of, do I think that Medicaid cuts are going to have an adverse impact for most anesthesiologists? Not in most cases. There's probably some where, if you're in private practice and you're very integrated in, you know, you've got a payer mix that's largely Medicaid, you're going to have to ask the hospital to participate. There's a thing called a stipend where a hospital will pay an anesthesia group, if they contract with a private group, to basically make them whole, to take them from that $120 an hour to the market wage. And the hospital pays the anesthesia group the difference in order to employ the docs. This may result in stipends having to be adjusted in order to keep services running. But I think that for individual doctors, my expectation is that this will just be a speed bump for now, hopefully.
All right. Fingers crossed. Justin, this has been great. We've covered so much good stuff. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. What do you recommend the audience check out for fun?
Yes. So I recently watched The Accountant 2, which, I got to be honest, I was reflecting, I didn't like it as much as the original The Accountant movie with Ben Affleck, which, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a hilarious, like, you're expecting a certain kind of thing, and it turns out that he's this, it's like, it's an action, I'll just say it's an action movie, okay? It's called The Accountant, and it's an action movie. So it's one that I really enjoyed. So The Accountant 2 is okay. The Accountant 1 would be worth checking out if that's your genre. In terms of reading material, there's a book I really like that I have recommended to a number of clients, and I'm going to grab a copy of it here. I'll hold it up so you can see it, Dr. Wolpaw. It's called Die with Zero by this guy named Bill Perkins. I think that this is a really good paradigm for financial decision-making that is, I'll say, like, against the conventional wisdom. So the typical, you know, like, save X dollars and make sure you're diversified, yada, yada. And, like, that's a well-trodden path to wealth building. This guy's thesis is, like, your goal is not to die with many millions. Your goal is to use the resources you have during your life to live the most amazing life possible. And so there's a lot of countercultural, as it relates to traditional financial advice, advice and ideas, and if nothing else, food for thought, where he gives a sort of a different lens through which you can view financial decision making. So if you're a physician who's on their wealth building journey and you're looking for something to sort of stimulate some creative thinking in terms of how do I use my resources in a way that's going to allow me to live the most rich life possible in all of the meanings of that word, then Die with Zero by Bill Perkins is a fun read, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Awesome. Thanks, Justin. If you are a frequent listener and you listened to the last episode, you will know that Dr. Kai's Torah recommended the Solo Leveling books. And I had said to him at the time that he had recommended them to me, and I had just started them, and I was kind of interested but not sure. And I will tell you that this is interesting. My understanding is it's like a manga, you know, set of novels in Korea. You can get the graphic novel version, but the novel version is also available. And that's what Tim read, and that's what he recommended I read. And so since the last time that I talked to him, I have now finished them. And there's 8 of them. They're short. They're very – I mean, you could put all 8 together and have, like, one long book, like one Brandon Sanderson-length book. But but they are – I got very hooked. I mean, it is really – if you like fantasy, it is really an interesting – a little bit different than kind of your normal, but very – very addicting. I got very into them. The ending was fine. I would say it's maybe not the best ending of all time, but definitely they're a quick read and an entertaining one. So I would recommend, just as Tim did, the Solo Leveling books by the author's name is Chu Gong, Chugong. All right, Justin, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Wolpaw.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew.
Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do.
Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply. In app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.